Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
So this is the second part of my interview with John Bosenecker, author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, The Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. Part two of this interview covers Frank Hamer's work as a Prohibition agent, and then on through the Depression and up through the deaths of Bonnie and Clyde. Let's skip the intro music this time and go right into the interview. So Hamer goes from riding horses on the range at the beginning of his career to chasing down bootleggers in cars during Prohibition. I'd love it if you could talk about this transition.
So Frank Hamer's career began as a horseback lawman on the Rio Grande, and then he transitioned over into a motorized gangbuster. And so that was his career sort of paralleled what happened in Texas and in the American experience of that era, where you went from a rural horse and buggy society to a much more urban motorized society. So Hamer didn't do any of this as out of some sort of desire to be a pioneer. He simply adapted to new conditions. And one of those was Prohibition. And so Hamer, in this part of his life, was not a drinking man. And a lot of people didn't like Prohibition, very, very unpopular. A lot of people, I think if anything, it probably made drinking even more appealing to many people, because suddenly it was illegal. And so Hamer, you know, I think he would drink a little bit socially, but he certainly, drinking was not any part of his life. And so for him, it was just another law to enforce. And he did get assigned to El Paso as a Prohibition officer. This would be in about 1920. And there had been many El Paso officers. I think there were quite a few El Paso officers were killed in the space of 1 or 2 years. And Hamer told these Prohibition officers, how are so many of you guys getting killed down here? And they said, well, you know, we get a tip that mezcal or whiskey or some kind of booze is being brought across the border. So we go down to the river and we order them to surrender, and they start shooting and one of us gets shot or killed. And Hamer says, that's not how you do it. And he says, I'll show you how. So soon after that, they get a tip of a gang of smugglers are going to bring mezcal across the border. And most of these smugglers, this is at the end of the Mexican Revolution. So most of the smugglers are former members of Pancho Villa's army who have been rendered unemployed by the end of the revolution. So now what do? They become smugglers. So Hamer and three or four of his men, including at least one other ranger and a couple of Prohibition agents, go down to this sort of cutoff island that's just south of downtown El Paso. There was a section of land where the river, the Rio Grande, had shifted. And in flood time, the river would flood up and then it would recede, and then the river bed would move. And so there's this area, kind of a no man's land, that sometimes was in Mexico, sometimes in the U.S., and that's where they set up an ambush in a ditch. And pretty soon, along comes six of these smugglers with the huge bottles of mezcal strapped to the back of their donkeys or mules, and they're all carrying guns, and they can see them clearly in the moonlight. And Hamer and the other ranger, who both had semi-automatic rifles, immediately stood up and opened fire. And the rest of the posse then immediately started shooting, and they killed them all, killed six of them without any order to surrender. And then Hamer stepped forward, and there's several accounts of this shooting, and he pokes the dead bodies with his boot, and he says, "Now yell manos arriba at these sons of bitches." And manos arriba means hands up. And so Hamer's point was, you know, you give these guys an opportunity to surrender, then you're asking for it to get shot. And so, as I point out in the book, if this was a law enforcement operation, then what Hamer and his men did was murder, because they shot these smugglers down in cold blood without giving them a chance to surrender. However, if you look at it as a military operation, then what they did was exactly correct, because when you're on an ambush and you ambush the enemy, you don't order the enemy to surrender. You don't give them warning that you're there. You just open fire and try to take out the threat. So the listener can decide which one they think is the way to judge Frank Hamer.
There have always been Western stereotypes, gunslingers or gunfighters, lawmen. And you make the argument in your book that Hamer was a gunfighter and a lawman.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the problem with the term gunfighter, the term gunslinger, I'll point out, I never, ever use that, because that's a modern term. It was coined in the 1920s or 30s. And so, but even the term gunfighter, you know, if you watch a film and there's, you know, hundreds of movies about a wandering gunfighter, even my favorite Western, Shane is a wandering gunfighter who ends up in Wyoming. Well, there's no such thing as a wandering gunfighter. A gunfighter is just a guy who was good with a gun, wouldn't back down from a fight. Some were lawmen, some were bad men. And so gunfighter, there was no occupation of gunfighter. There were men who were good with guns who would be hired as a police officer, hired as a Texas Ranger, hired as a mine guard, hired maybe to put down a labor strike. This would be after 1900. But so technically there really wasn't any such thing as a gunfighter, but there were certainly men like Doc Holliday or John Wesley Hardin who were principally gamblers, and because they hung out in bars and saloons and brothels and places like that, they got into a lot of gunfights. I tell everybody, if you were in the old West and you stayed out of a bar, you stayed out of a gambling hall, you stayed out of a brothel, you probably wouldn't get shot. But if you spent your time hanging out in places like that, you greatly increase your chances of getting shot, because people there, they're up to no good. They're fighting over women. They're fighting over money. They're all drunk. And those are all recipes for getting into gunfights. So Hamer, in the sense of being a gunfighter, yes, he was a gunfighter. By our modern definition, by his own account, he took part in 52 shooting incidents. By my account, he killed approximately 23 men, mostly in the line of duty. You can argue whether some of the shootings were proper or not. In my opinion, they were. But so he was definitely one of the greatest gunfighters of the old West, simply by virtue of the fact that he lived in an incredibly violent era. He was always sent to the worst trouble spots in Texas, whether it was in Borger in the 1920s, the toughest town in Texas, in Mejia, to tame these oil towns of North Texas, whether he was sent to East Texas to battle the Klan, sent to South Texas to battle Mexican bandits and revolutionaries, sent to El Paso to battle smugglers. his chances of being in a gunfight were massively increased because he was always sent to the most dangerous or violent areas in Texas. And he also didn't hesitate to shoot. Those things combined to these 52 gunfights. And of the 52 gunfights, I think I detail about half of them in the book. The other half are lost to history.
So not only was he good with a gun, but he was a really exceptional detective, too. And he would be assigned at one point to solve some of Texas's cold cases. Is that right?
That's correct. And when you really see his intelligence is in these accounts that I found about these cold cases in the mid-1920s, when he was assigned as a special investigator for the Adjutant General of Texas, and there were a number of cold murder cases. And in each case, Hamer was either able to arrest the culprit, or in retrospect, it's obvious that the culprit that Hamer focused on was guilty. In one case was the so-called Corpus Christi bombing, where a young guy was dating a beautiful co-ed at the University of Texas. This is in the early 20s. He's a World War I veteran, and the father, the girl's father, who lives in Corpus Christi with the rest of his wife and his son, opposed this match. And one day the father goes to the back porch where a package has been delivered, and he tries to open it, and there's a massive explosion which kills the father and mortally wounded his son. And there's a photograph of the back porch of this house, and a third of the house is demolished by this dynamite bomb. And nobody could figure out who did it. Well, Hamer was assigned to investigate a number of years later, and he focused on this this young guy as the main suspect. And incredibly, the case was brought, and eventually a jury acquitted him. The VFW came out in favor of this guy. They couldn't believe he would do anything like it, but the circumstantial evidence that he had the motive, the opportunity, he was identified as the same man who had sent the explosive device. I don't know what else you need. And so Hamer was not able to get a conviction on that case, but he certainly solved the crime. And he did that with a number of very brutal murders. And another one happened near Austin in a neighborhood that was leveled to make way for the Austin airport. And there was a small farm, and a young, beautiful young woman and her parents were all found murdered. And again, Hamer identified the culprit, and he was eventually released for alleged lack of evidence, but the evidence against him was overwhelming. Hamer actually brought in Charles Goddard, who was the father of American criminology, and Goddard had utilized, the first person to utilize the comparison microscope. And Hamer, from the suspect, he recovered the murder weapon, and Goddard put it under the comparison microscope. Goddard came to Austin, appeared before the Travis County grand jury. He shot the gun. He showed the bullet taken from the gun and matched the striations in the bullets that Hamer had obtained from the dead bodies. The case was so cold, that Hamer had the victim's bodies exhumed to get the bullets out of them, because the local police were so incompetent, they didn't even do that. And but this jury of very unsophisticated Texas farmers, this grand jury, refused to accept this technology that today everybody accepts. I mean, this CSI stuff is really, if anything, we've gone overboard on it today. People, jurors, the want CSI on a bar fight or something like that, and the prosecutors have to tell him, we don't have CSI, this ain't a whodunit, it's a why done it. In any event, the grand jury refused to indict him, and this was just shocking because Hamer used the most cutting-edge technology available to prove. And so I identify this guy in the book, and, you know, at least for posterity, he is the man who murdered this family because he was a jilted lover.
So Prohibition ends. The Depression begins. What did Hamer find himself doing at the end of Prohibition?
After Prohibition, he was actually fired by Ma Ferguson. So Miriam Ferguson was the wife of Jim Ferguson, the governor of Texas. Jim Ferguson was the most corrupt governor in Texas history. And he was impeached by the Texas legislature because of his corruption and prevented from ever running for governor again. So what he does some years later is that he gets his wife, Miriam, to run for governor. And she runs on this platform, you get two governors for the price of one. And the Fergusons were just a disaster as Texas governors. And one of the things she did, the Rangers had campaigned against her, which again, in a modern day America, police officers and deputy sheriffs, law enforcement officers, generally are not supposed to get involved in an election campaign, although they do at labor. The police labor unions typically do get involved and support various candidates that are supportive of the police or supportive of law and order issues. But in this particular case, the Rangers actually went to the Democratic convention in Texas and tried to get her denied the nomination as the Texas candidate for governor. And she received it due to her husband's political connections. And so both Ma and Pa Ferguson were just enraged. So as soon as she was sworn in, she basically fired Hamer and the rest of the Ranger force and then hired a bunch of Rangers, of whom many were totally incompetent. Not all, but many were incompetent. And they were called Ferguson Rangers. And to this day, it's a badge of shame in Texas if one of your ancestors was a Ferguson Ranger. So Hamer found himself unemployed, which had happened to him off and on over his career. And he was working as a private investigator when he was contacted and asked to track down Bonnie and Clyde.
So that's a perfect segue. I'd love to shift to Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie Parker, Clyde Barrow. Would you mind giving us a history of this couple, how they met and began their life of crime together?
I'll have to give you kind of a vague description. I'm no Bonnie and Clyde expert, but essentially Clyde Barrow was born in Texas, and as a very young boy, he was arrested for stealing chickens in the early 1920s. The typical myth is that the depression and poverty drove him into a career of crime, but he was a chicken thief 7 or 8 years before the depression even hit Texas. So Clyde Barrow was a career criminal. He was a small man, clearly had a small man's complex. He was sent to the Texas State Penitentiary. I believe it's authentic that he cut off a couple of his toes to get out of a work detail and was eventually paroled. And he met Bonnie Parker in West Dallas, which was an impoverished, it's called a slum by many of the writers of Bonnie and Clyde, but it really wasn't a slum. It was a typical rural area in Texas. With outhouses in the back, no plumbing. The upbringing that Bonnie and Clyde had was no different than just about anybody else had in Texas in that era, because a lot of people grew up in rural Texas. They grew up in farms. They didn't have plumbing. you had to get water out of a well, and those things didn't cause you to become a notorious armed robber. You know, so there was a barrow I state in my book, and I believe that this is not much of an exaggeration, is that Clyde Barrow's parents were two of the worst parents in Texas history, because almost every child they raised became a convicted felon.
How long were Bonnie and Clyde together? How many banks did they rob? How many people did they kill? Hopefully I'm not asking you something too specific, just off the top of your head.
Yeah, you know, I believe they killed 9. During their career lasted only a few years. In that time, they believe they killed 9 people, most of them law enforcement officers. The unfortunate thing about Bonnie and Clyde history is that a number of the authors are in love with Bonnie or something. There's this thing that if Clyde was operating by himself, I think you'd get a fairer judgment of his life and of his criminal career. But because his partner was a woman, and on top of that, a very extremely attractive young woman, some of these writers get swept up in this romantic notion of crime. And anybody who's done any kind of or had any firsthand experience knows that crime and criminals are never pretty. You know, as a police officer, I made hundreds, if not more than 1,000 arrests. And these people that you're arresting are not the kind of people that you'd really want to make a movie about. They're not people you'd want to write a novel about. They're really pretty, either very violent, very drunk, very drug addicted, very fouled up people, some of who need help very badly, and many who just need to be locked up behind bars to keep away from society. And so because Bonnie is a woman, Clyde gets a lot of slack by a lot of authors and writers about the Bonnie and Clyde story, and he doesn't deserve it. They were pretty cold-blooded. These murders, some of the writers claim that Clyde was forced into his career of crime, which is an absolute crock, that Clyde only fired his gun when he was cornered. You know, if that was true, why did Bonnie and Clyde and Buck Barrow fire fully automatic weapons and narrowly miss a school bus full of children? This is a story that's in all the newspapers, and you don't find it in a single book about Bonnie and Clyde. You don't find these accounts of Bonnie shooting in gunfights. So Bonnie was clearly led into this life of crime by Clyde Barrow. She was in love with him. She would do anything for Clyde. If Clyde died, she wanted to die with him. She wanted to go down together, like she said in the famous poem that she wrote. And so, but Bonnie also was a reckless with firearms. The story that Bonnie never shot a gun at anybody is complete nonsense. There's plenty of newspaper accounts and firsthand accounts of her taking part in these wild gun battles that the Barrow gang took part in.
The account of Bonnie shooting at school children, that was during a bank holdup in southern Minnesota, wasn't it?
Yeah, so during a bank holdup in Lucerne, Indiana, Bonnie fired at unarmed citizens. And following a bank robbery in Okabena, Minnesota, Bonnie and Clyde and Clyde's brother Buck Barrow fired at citizens with shotguns and Browning automatic rifles, narrowly missing a school bus full of children. And Bonnie also shot at lawmen in gunfights in Joplin, Missouri, and at Dexter, Iowa. And so she was, and to use the popular term of that era, she was the quintessential gun moll.
You break some myths in your book. Their time together was far from romantic, you write. They fought constantly. They both had gonorrhea.
Yes, and these things come out of the FBI file. So one of the things that was very fortunate for me is the FBI file on Bonnie and Clyde had been long lost, and it was discovered, I believe, in an old a file cabinet in the basement of the federal building in Dallas in about 2008. And the Bonnie and Clyde historians, and there's these historians that are avocational historians who've just done incredible research on Bonnie and Clyde, and I hope that they publish it. Some of these Bonnie and Clyde historians learned about this discovery, and they, you know, begged the FBI to release the file. So the FBI released it, but they redacted all the names and identifying information, which is cuckoo because these people have all been dead for probably a generation. So some of the historians petitioned the FBI to release an unredacted version, and they finally did it. And there is a copy that was on the FBI website at one point. I hope it still is. Some of it's very difficult to read. But the FBI reports are in that file, and I'm the first researcher to use them and to publish something based on that. And that's why my book is the first and only book that has a properly researched or at least an accurate account of how Hamer tracked down Bonnie and Clyde.
I definitely want to ask you about that, but I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind walking through a typical Bonnie and Clyde bank robbery with us. All of these Depression-era bank robbing gangs did things differently. Some cased joints out far in advance. Others just went in guns blazing without any real plan. How did they rob a bank?
Well, Bonnie and Clyde actually didn't rob that many banks. Mostly they robbed Piggly Wiggly stores, which is like an early sort of chain type of grocery store. They robbed gas stations. They did all these penny ante stick-ups. And some of their murders were done in the course of these hold-ups. Now, they just didn't go in and shoot everybody in sight. They would hold people at gunpoint. They'd usually have Bonnie out in the getaway car, and then they would grab the loot. And they'd, you know, like I say, they would shoot if they were shot at. But Clyde also fired recklessly. And so they just fire, and maybe they just intended to issue covering fire or suppression fire, but you don't shoot suppression fire at a school bus full of children. So most of their robberies were not bank robberies. They did some bank robberies, definitely. But most of their robberies were just these penny ante little stick-ups where they just go into a store, they'd hold up the storekeeper, grab the money out of the cash register, jump in the car, and take off. And that's how they rob banks also.
He would hit up armories too, right? And steal guns.
Yes, in two cases in the Midwest and in Texas, Clyde burglarized a National Guard armory. And that's where they got the Browning automatic rifles that they carried. The story that you see in film that they carried Thompson submachine guns is totally wrong. The automatic weapons that they had were BARs or Browning automatic rifles. There's no account of Bonnie and Clyde having, or no accurate account of Bonnie and Clyde having a Thompson submachine gun.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
You write in your book that Hamer was kind of following Bonnie and Clyde's exploits in the newspapers like everyone else, and then suddenly he was approached with a very interesting proposition.
Yeah, Lee Simmons, who was the head of the Texas prison system, realized that there was no organized manhunt for Bonnie and Clyde. They'd show up. What would happen is Clyde would steal these new Ford V8s, which were the fastest and most powerful cars that you could get that, you know, weren't like a Packard that only some Hollywood star had in, you know, Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills or something like that. But the kind of car that the average person had was a much less powerful vehicle than a Ford V8. And so Clyde stole the Ford V8s and he'd drive for hundreds and hundreds of miles after a robbery to escape. And he drove so much that it was almost impossible to predict where he would show up. And so the manhunt for him was very, very disorganized. He'd commit a robbery in Minnesota, then he'd show up in Iowa, then he'd show up in Arkansas, then he'd be back in Texas. So Lee Simmons knew we needed to get an expert manhunter after Bonnie and Clyde. And Hamer at that point was unemployed and the choice was fairly obvious. And Hamer immediately agreed when Lee Simmons came to his home in Austin and made this proposition. And so Hamer was already had a Texas Highway Patrol commission. So even though he was fired as a Texas Ranger, he wanted to have some kind of law enforcement commission. And so he had this commission as a Texas Highway Patrolman because the Texas Rangers and the Highway Patrol were part of the same arm of government. And so then he was made a special investigator for the Texas prison system, and that's how he was paid. But his law enforcement authority came as a Texas Highway Patrolman, which was an unpaid position, kind of like a volunteer fireman.
So how was Frank Hamer able to track Bonnie and Clyde? What leads did he follow?
So the story of how Hamer tracked down Bonnie and Clyde is a very long and detailed one and comes principally from the FBI file, which, as I said, was not released an unredacted version was not released until 2009. And the short version is that Hamer immediately contacted both the FBI and the Dallas Sheriff's Department, and a Dallas detective named Bob Alcorn became his partner. And Alcorn knew Clyde personally, had once arrested him. And Hamer suspected that Henry Methvin, who had escaped in this prison break at Eastham, and this is a famous break when Bonnie and Clyde freed some of their gang members and killed a prison guard in East Texas. Well, Methvin had escaped also with the gang. And when Methvin, Hamer investigated Methvin a little bit and found that he came from this very poor family in northwestern Louisiana. So Hamer and Alcorn, they drove to Shreveport, Louisiana, where they met with local officers, asked a lot of questions, told them to be on the lookout for Bonnie and Clyde, because Hamer recognized that Bonnie and Clyde needed support. And there had been efforts to try to capture Bonnie and Clyde when they would come to visit their families in the Dallas area, and those efforts had failed. So Hamer focused on the Methvin family. And so what happened was Hamer drove to Arcadia and other places in Louisiana, but in Arcadia in particular, they met with Henderson Jordan, who was a rookie sheriff of Bienville Parish, and they asked him to watch out for the two fugitives. And at that point, Henderson Jordan really didn't know anything about the Barrow gang until Hamer explained to him that Methvin was believed to have lived, at least at one point, in his parish. So Hamer then interviewed one of the gang members in the Texas prison at Huntsville, and this prisoner, Hilton Bybee, made a full confession and gave Hamer all kinds of details about the gang. And he confirmed, this is the most important thing, that Henry Methvin had stayed with Bonnie and Clyde and now was part of the Barrow gang. And so Bybee, his confession is in the FBI file and details all this and makes it clear how Hamer really got on the scent. And so the FBI assigned an agent named Edward Dowd to work closely with him. Hamer searched all over, not just trying to keep an eye on Louisiana. He also kept an eye on other places where Clyde had frequented and managed to recover some of the stolen property that the gang had, including an automobile that the gang had stolen. And so Hamer then had asked Henderson Jordan to try to, the sheriff, Henderson Jordan, to try to locate the Methvin family. And Jordan drove for weeks to try to find this family. They were basically an itinerant family. They were dirt poor and moved frequently, often squatting in little cabins or farmhouses. And finally, Jordan located Methvin. There were several meetings between the Methvin family, the FBI, and Hamer. And the father, Ivy Methvin, wanted a pardon for his son, Henry, in exchange for giving up Bonnie and Clyde. And these meetings, again, are detailed in great detail in the FBI reports. And Hamer obtained a written promise from Ma Ferguson that Henry Methvin would be pardoned for the crimes that he had committed in Texas. And most of the crimes he committed were in Texas, one in Oklahoma. So she couldn't give him a pardon for that, but she gave him a pardon or offered to give him a pardon for his crimes in Texas. And so as a result of that, Ivy Methvin then helped set up the ambush in which Bonnie and Clyde were killed.
What day were they killed?
It was May 1934. So what happened was Hamer and the other officers had several more meetings with the Methvin family. And finally, on the night of May 22, 1934, they got word that Bonnie and Clyde would visit the Methvin house that was located near this little crossroads called Sales. It's really not a town. It's just a crossroads with some buildings. This is, again, in Louisiana. And that Bonnie and Clyde would be coming to the Methvin house the next morning. So Hamer and his men set up an ambush on the highway between Gibbsland and Sales, and they waited through the dark. And what they did was they had Henry Methvin, father, Ivy Methvin, was with them, and they had him park his truck across from where they were and take a tire off so that when Bonnie and Clyde approached, they would want to stop and at least see what he was doing. Because what they figured was that Clyde was such a lead foot that if they tried to stop him, he'd just hit the gas and take off. And this had happened repeatedly when other lawmen had tried to capture Clyde Barrow. But they just Hamer decided that if we can put this vehicle out there, this truck, get Clyde to stop, then we could at least have a chance at being able to capture them. And so one of the things that happened with the posse was that Hamer insisted that they open fire without warning, which is exactly what he had done in El Paso in 1921. Henderson Jordan, though, insisted we have to give them a chance. We have to at least give them an order to surrender, and if they don't, then we'll open fire. And so the posse, contrary to the movie, nobody in the posse had a Thompson submachine gun. A Thompson submachine gun shot .45 caliber pistol bullets, which were not high powerful. They were not high power bullets. They were not armor piercing bullets. That gun, Hamer used them occasionally, but he certainly didn't use one in the Barrow ambush. The posse men had Remington semi-automatic rifles called a Model 8. They had semi-automatic shotguns, and they had a Browning automatic rifle. And so Hamer's plan was the lawman that had the BAR would open fire and bust the engine, because the BAR was a .30-06 weapon. It fired .30-06 bullets, extremely powerful, that could easily penetrate the walls of a vehicle and would also blow out the engine if you fired into the engine compartment with it. And so he figured that would stop the vehicle, and then we can get the rest of them to surrender or kill them, depending upon who won this argument. So during the night, they argued back and forth whether to give them a warning or not. And finally, Hamer consented. It was Henderson Jordan's state. It was his parish. Hamer was the man in charge because he had more experience. I think he had two or three times the experience of the entire posse combined. Henderson Jordan had been sheriff for only a couple of years. Manny Gault, his former ranger partner, had a few years experience as a Texas Ranger. Bob Alcorn, the deputy sheriff from Dallas, I can't remember exactly how many years he had, but it was under 10. And then Ted Hinton was another rookie officer who wrote a book later that's full of baloney. He wrote a book called Ambush, which was published after his death. And it's just has very little value for a historian. And much of this contents of the book is just a crock. I should probably mention that Hinton's story that he was in love with Bonnie and knew her, and she used to serve him as a restaurant, is all just a complete fabrication. But in any event, Jordan won the argument, and Jordan's posse, his deputy sheriff, was I believe he was the least experienced man in the posse. And so when the vehicle approached, Hamer said he could hear the engine whining like a sewing machine as it got close in the distance. And Clyde came over a rise to their right, came down, saw Ivy Methvin's truck. They pull over, And what happened was that Sheriff Jordan's deputy was so nervous that before Jordan could even give the order to surrender, his deputy opened fire. And then what police call today sympathetic fire, that people, officers hear the other gunfire and immediately open fire. I never bought that personally. I would think that the well-trained officer who's made, felony arrests without ever shooting anybody is not going to shoot unless he actually sees a danger himself. But in any event, the entire posse opened fire after the first shots were fired and riddled the car with 167 bullets and buckshot. Then Bonnie and Clyde, they approached, and Bonnie and Clyde had basically an arsenal on wheels. There's plenty of photographs showing all the automatic weapons, the pistols, thousands of rounds of ammunition that were all taken out of the vehicle. And so that was the end of Bonnie and Clyde and the beginning of this huge legend.
Wow. So J. Edgar Hoover always wanted to take credit for the capture of these Depression era outlaws. What did Hoover think about Hamer's involvement in stopping Bonnie and Clyde?
Hoover was mad as a hornet. It was Hoover's own fault because he had assigned several agents to work with Hamer, and the agent that worked with him, his name was Kendall, in Louisiana. Just a few days before the ambush, he sent a written message to Hoover, which is in the file, and he says, things are heating up. We're about to get them. I need to be with Hamer. I need to be in on this. And Hoover wouldn't allow him to do it. The agent was working on a kidnapping case in southern Louisiana. And so Hamer had notified Agent Kendall to be there, and Kendall missed out, and therefore the FBI could not take credit. And J. Edgar Hoover, who, as there's been ample books about him, you know, he was really a powerful and commanding figure in American law enforcement, and he was largely responsible for the professionalization of the FBI, for the bringing in of the latest technology, fingerprinting and ballistics. But at the same time, Hoover was, you know, morally questionable. There's plenty of stories that he blackmailed politicians so that he could remain in office. And he was incredibly jealous. And that comes out in later correspondence that I managed to get. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI file. They show that they had something like 30 files on Frank Hamer, most of which were destroyed. But the existing files show that Hamer was just really hated by Hoover because Hoover was jealous of him. And he said that Hamer was a publicity seeker. And he got Hamer mixed up with one of his brothers at one point was criticizing Hamer when in fact it was Hamer's brother, Estel Hamer, who Hoover was criticizing. But Hoover, because of this ambush of Bonnie and Clyde, it kind of ignited this insane jealousy by Hoover toward Frank Hamer.
One would think that after something like this, I mean, news of Bonnie and Clyde was plastered in papers across the country. So many Americans were carefully following their crime spree. Once the duo went down, Hamer became a hero, right? You would think he would have his choice of plum positions after that. He'd be hailed as a national hero. Is that what happened to him?
Well, as I point out in the book, there was, because the Ferguson Rangers were so incompetent, and there were a bunch of scandals involving them. One of the captains committed suicide. There were all these other things that happened. There was a move in Austin to abolish the state ranger force. And all of a sudden, the Texas public became aware that the only reason Bonnie and Clyde had been tracked down was because this Captain Hamer, and even though Hamer was no longer a Ranger captain, everybody considered him to be a Texas Ranger. And he was referred to in the newspapers repeatedly as Captain Hamer. That was his official title. And the newspapermen kind of advanced that by calling him an ex-Ranger. But in the popular mind, it was the famous Texas Ranger Captain Frank Hamer who tracked down Bonnie and Clyde. And suddenly, the Ranger force became, it was a Texas institution. It had been since the 1840s. And suddenly it became unthinkable to abolish the Ranger force because of what Hamer had done. And so what happened was the Texas Rangers were then folded into a new Department of Public Safety, which still is how the Rangers are part of the Texas state government. The Texas Highway Patrol and Texas Rangers are part of the Department of Public Safety. And so that is how Frank Hamer saved the Texas Rangers. However, he had made political enemies in Austin during his career, and the new governor, who was very much at odds with Hamer over an old case where Hamer had defended a former Ranger who had been prosecuted by the governor of Texas when he was a young district attorney and 15 years earlier. And Hamer had been very vocal about how his friend should not have been prosecuted when, in fact, the Hamer's friend deserved to be prosecuted and was sent to prison for shooting a black man at the railroad yards in Waco. And this is something that Hamer thought was outrageous, because he had this black and white viewpoint of police are good and criminals are bad, which is generally true. But sometimes you get bad police, and Hamer's buddy was a bad cop and did a bad shooting. He killed two black men. Both times he claimed he killed them in the line of duty. And the second instance was not true. And so Allred, who later became the governor, prosecuted him, sent the man to prison. Hamer was vocal in criticizing Allred. And when Allred was elected governor of Texas, he refused to appoint Frank Hamer as a captain of the Rangers. And that effectively marked the end of his career as a Ranger captain, although Hamer did keep his special Ranger commission. So he continued to have a police power as a special Ranger up until his death in 1955.
So did he live a happy life at the end? How did things end for Frank Hamer?
Yes, he was very respected. His home in Austin is still standing. He lived there until he died. He continued working until 1954, a year before his death. He worked as a strike breaker on the Houston docks, became a very controversial figure there. I believe history supports, my research supports, the work that he did as a strike breaker. There, he prevented violence on the docks. The Longshoremen's Union in particular hated him, but just because they called him a strike breaker, but in fact, he was really not a strike breaker. He was a security guard. He had a guard, a company of guards who protected the ships and the shipbuilding industry from violence by strikers. So he never did any strike breaking, although that was what he was accused of, being a strike breaker. But yeah, he did have a lucrative business, but he died in very modest circumstances. There are stories that he had a stroke and was, you know, in his house for 5 years. Or those are all crazy. He was out working up to a year before his death, and he suffered a stroke. He was a lifelong smoker. He was not a drinking man, but he did become a very heavy drinker. His older son, Frank Jr., was killed on Iwo Jima, serving in the United States Marine Corps. And Hamer never really recovered from that. And you see photographs of him taken only a few months after, and even though Hamer was only in his 60s, he looked like he was in his 80s. And by all accounts, he started to drink, often heavily drinking after that. He was very, very close to his two natural sons and his two adopted daughters. And so this death of his oldest boy just shook him to the very foundation and cast a long shadow over the final years of his life.
Wow. Okay. Well, this has been awesome. I do want to ask you, because you've written so many books about some pretty interesting characters, is there a particular book you've written that you think might not have gotten the attention it should have? Or is there a book maybe that you think my listeners might be especially interested in?
Yeah, actually, two of my books, they're well known to Western buffs. But one of my early books that was published about 20 years ago is called Lawman, The Life and Times of Harry Morse. And Harry Morse was the most famous sheriff on the West Coast in the 19th century. He broke up the Latino bandit gangs of Central California. He took part in the most famous gunfight of the California frontier when he killed Juan Soto in a famous pistol duel in 1871. And later, Morse became famous for capturing Black Bart, America's most prolific stage robber. And the other book that really was a book that should have been written many, many years ago is my biography of Bob Paul. It's called When Law Was in the Holster. And it's the biography of Bob Paul, who was a pioneer lawman in California. Then he went to, he was a shotgun messenger for Wells Fargo after serving as a sheriff in the California Gold Rush. And then in Arizona, he befriended the Earp brothers and played a prominent role in the battle of the Earp boys against the cowboys in Tombstone. And he became the most famous sheriff outside of Wyatt Earp. He was the most famous sheriff of Arizona history.
So I have to ask you, after your book was published and your Texas author friends finally read it, did they regret not taking on the subject themselves?
If they regretted it, they didn't tell me. I tell you, they all loved it. And so it's kind of funny. I've told some people some of the reviews that you get. I read them sometimes on Amazon. And one reviewer wrote, "Could this author have possibly said any more bad things about our lovely state of Texas?" Because I go into a lot of detail about Jim Crow and the Klan. And so, and then another guy wrote and he said, "My family has lived in West Texas for 150 years. And this writer, even though he's from California, he nailed it." And I think that was probably the most gratifying review that I got. I made a lot, you know, I've been all over Texas. I love Texas. I got friends all over the place. Been there many, many times. But to have a Texan say that I nailed Texas is very gratifying.
Oh, I can only imagine. Incredibly satisfying, I'm sure. Well, this book is everywhere, and people can go on to Amazon to view your full list of books there, everything you've written.
Correct.
Well, this has been so great. Thank you for agreeing to spend some time with me on this.
Well, I really appreciate it, and thanks for having me.
Again, my guest has been John Bosenecker, author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.